call a meeting of the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations to order and ask council to take the roll.
Representatives Cobain?
Here.
Fowler?
Here.
Vito?
Here.
Lewisberg?
Here.
Mr. Berry?
Here.
Mr. Frye?
Here.
Mr. Kessel? Mr. Martinson?
Here.
Mr. Radnick?
Here.
Mr. Rea?
Here.
Mr. Yantas?
Here.
Ms. Pelham?
Here.
We have a quorum. The minutes of the December 8th meeting, it says December 18th on the agenda, it should be December 8th. Minutes of December 8th meeting were made available online, and is there a motion to approve the minutes of the December 8th meeting?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
We have motion, is there a second?
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. The first item on our agenda is a presentation regarding collection of extraordinary road use fees. And do we have someone here from the Highway Patrol who's going to explain this handout we have?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. My name is Dave Kleppe. I'm the Chief of Staff for Highway Patrol, and just showing up this morning on behalf of Colonel Prochniak. You should have copies of a report that we provided for calendar year 2009, 2010, and 2011 regarding overload collections as well as the number of overload or actual overloads that we assessed as Highway Patrol. And there was another document that we provided, just a one-pager that should show some collections that were handled by county officials that were forwarded to the state. And for some reason over the years, they've actually come to Highway Patrol, and then they end up getting deposited in the state highway fund. And so we work with the Treasurer's Office on that process.
Do we have that other hand?
Major Kleppe, is that the second page of each, or did I miss something? On the table there is what we distributed. Maybe you can see if I missed something. If so, I'll quickly have that copied and brought down.
Yes, sir, I believe that you're missing the one page that was sent just yesterday.
Oh.
And I've got a copy of it here. I can certainly just go over it unless...
I'll check my mail and have someone bring it down.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, I can just do a quick review on the fees that were collected, that were actually collected by county officials that were forwarded to the state. There was only $16,400 for calendar 2009, $37,360 for calendar 2010, and $30,895 for calendar 2011. And I do have some additional comments, unless you've got some questions about those documents before I run through these.
Well, one handout we have is 2009, 2010, 2011 overloads by county and road type. And could you just kind of walk us through that and explain what we're looking at?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, the 2011 overloads by county and roadway is what it's titled, and then it shows the different dollars collected. There should be three calendar years. 09 is on one page, 10 on another, and 11 on another, and it's showing an increase in those overload collections by Highway Patrol over the three calendar year periods. We actually had, looks like, a total of $483,949 for 09 as a total, and it is broken down by county, interstate, and then other state and federal routes as well. The total for 2010 at the bottom there is $821,150. And then the total for 2011 is $1,940,744. And in talking with our motor carrier operations commander, it sounds like, you know, year to date, we're actually nearly 200,000 already. So we're really on a track for some additional increases in overloads that are being assessed, which we refer to as the extraordinary road use fees.
So it looks to me, sir, like we've got a pretty significant increase over those 3 years from 483,200 in 2009 to almost 2 million in 2011. And while there are certainly major increases on the state side, looks like the Highway Patrol hasn't been changing a whole lot. In fact, it went down in 2011. I'm looking at interstate, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, the actual, even though the counties are listed here, these would actually be overloads assessed by Highway Patrol. And so county, interstate, and other state and federal routes assessed by Highway Patrol.
All right. And so none of these figures are any assessments made by counties?
No, sir. That would be the other page that's in the process of being copied right now. And in fact, we don't know for sure how many collections there are by local county city officials, but those that were forwarded for the 09, 10, and 11 period are what I mentioned earlier. And for those three periods, it's $84,655 on local collections that were actually transmitted through us to the treasurer's office for deposit in the state highway fund. So they would be separate. That $84,000 total for that three calendar year period is separate from these other documents that list the county, interstate, and state collections and overloads for Highway Patrol.
Now, these funds that are assessed by the Highway Patrol on these different types of roads, all of those funds go where?
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, they actually get deposited in the state highway fund.
Do you have any comments on what this means, I guess, looks like if we look at Williams County, for example, in 2011, that they're almost half of the total.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, we've really done a lot of additional size and weight enforcement in some of those areas, and you know, some of these are maybe just some really large overloads, but if you look at the page, it shows the actual numbers of overload violations. Williams County did have 108 that we actually assessed on county roads. And we do provide assistance to the counties. The patrols provided truck weight enforcement assistance in the past and will continue to do so. We also provide training and technical support to local law enforcement. So some counties are in the process of gearing up with some additional weight enforcement capabilities with their own staff. So we do provide some technical assistance as far as what type of portable scales we use and that type of thing. As far as some, just to give you a little background that may be relevant as well, we do have some different methods of weighing trucks. The department owns six combination weigh inspection stations. You'll see those smaller buildings located in, we've got one west of Williston at the intersection of 85 and 2. We've got one at Joliet, which is south of the Canadian border on Interstate 29. We've got one on Interstate 94 on both ends, one at West Fargo, one at Beach. another one on the entrance to, it's in the Morton area, south on 29, south of Fargo, north of the South Dakota border. And then we've got one down at Bowman on US 85 as well. So those six combination way inspection stations are part of the system. And then in conjunction with the Department of Transportation, we've got some fixed scale locations at Minot, on the frontage road near the Department of Transportation facilities, also west of Devil's Lake in the DOT facility just south of Highway 2, and then also in the just within the facility area of DOT at Grand Forks. And we hope to have another one in Jamestown eventually, based on moving an older facility that used to be set up at Ellendale on 281, and that is in the process of being relocated to a Jamestown location. We've also got over 200 portable scales, and those are those low profile scales that are carried in the SUVs, and mainly SUVs. We've got about 25 troopers and also 8 non-sworn inspectors assigned to federal and state-funded motor carrier enforcement duties. And then there's also 2 motor carrier troopers that are assigned to operate 2 trailer scale systems that were purchased early last year. And they're mainly dealing with oil country, and they actually are able to set up in an area where DOT's got some drive-outs built for us, and we can safely set those up and run quite a bit of traffic through a scale that it's called a trailer scale. And so they're portable, so they can be moved, you know, in just a few hours to a different location, that type of thing.
We do have this other sheet that you referred to now, and perhaps you could give us a little explanation of this.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, as you can see, we've got just 2 counties that submitted fees, at least to the Highway Patrol. And from what I asked our accountant, you know, why we're involved in that, and I think it's just always been done that way. It must be some kind of a partnership that we've got with the treasurer's office. And since we do receipt our own overload fees, which are a civil penalty, we actually receipt these when they come in from the counties, and then like I said, they do get forwarded to the treasurer's office for deposit in the state highway fund. There were 4 counties in 2010, totaling $37,360, and then there were about 7, it looks like, here for last calendar year, totaling almost $31,000. And then there's a total here of all 3 calendar years for a total of $84,655 that came through from the counties that were assessed by county officials and just forwarded to the state.
Are there other counties that are also collecting that don't send it into the Highway Patrol?
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, I do not know that. You know, it could very well be the case, but I do not know that for sure.
I requested information from the treasurer's office on counties, and they said they had nothing. Everything went through the HP.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, I requested information from the treasurer's office, basically on the same question, if any money came directly to them from the counties, and I was told no, there wasn't, that you know, what came in came through the Highway Patrol. So I have no answers to if there is other funds out there, if there are other funds out there, if, how that's been handled. But they said they received none directly through the counties.
So that means either the counties don't collect any or they don't send it in. Do you have any other comments or things you'd like to bring to our attention?
Mr. Chairman, just dealing with another topic on the penalties, and I can certainly wait if you want to.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. dealing with the, as an agent, as an enforcement agency, we don't, we're neutral as far as the actual agenda item that deals with the appropriateness of the $100 fine for overweight vehicle violations. But if I could just provide some additional information and try and answer some questions. North Dakota Century Code 39-1205 and 39-1205.3 are the sections that address overweight vehicles on interstate and also non-interstate highways. I'd like to hand out our policy that deals with, it's an overload enforcement guideline is what it is for our field personnel. And if you can give me just a minute to get these passed out. Okay, does everybody have a copy? Just briefly, on page one of that four-page policy, it talks about use of the, you know, a written warning for overweight 1,000 pounds or less, and then there, we do issue the $20 citation in instances where they're just between 1,000 and 2,000 pounds over, and then we require that they get legal. And then also the actual overload civil fee assessment takes place in overloads over 2,000 pounds. And if you want to go to page four, the top of page four is that the actual extraordinary road use fee schedule that that is used. But the $20 overweight, it's really a penalty for operating overweight, and it's just a $20 moving violation. The penalty for operating without a permit, or if a person is operating in violation of conditions of a permit, that's where the $100 non-criminal violation is assessed. Any questions on our enforcement guidelines?
Any questions from the commission?
Mr. Chairman, in regards to the sheet we just got with the cash receipts by the Highway Patrol, last meeting we had the two ladies from the oil and gas producing counties represented. Were the dollars that are collected by that in conjunction with the sheets that we've received from the major today?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Radnick, as I recall, those were just the permit fees that they collected, which would be separate from the extraordinary road use penalty fee, I guess, is the appropriate term in this case.
Any other questions? Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else here wishing to comment on this particular issue?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Burst. I'm with the Association of Counties. I just reviewed the bill draft this morning, and the Association of Counties has always been in support of the concept outlined on the first page, which was the extraordinary use fees would go into the local political subdivisions for use on their roads. And I know, I don't know if the chairman wants to hear a whole recitation of the issue, but I just want to make sure the committee is clear. There are two funds when we talk about highway funds, the highway distribution formula and the highway fund. Under the current law, the overweight extraordinary use fees go into the highway fund, which funds the Department of Transportation. That does not get redistributed to the local political subdivisions. That would require the language to say the highway distribution formula, which is the distinction there, which we thought was kind of important when you understand where the money actually goes. Just regarding the bill draft itself, though.
I guess I would ask you to hold your comments on the bill draft until after it's been presented to the commission, which is what's the next item on the agenda.
Certainly, certainly.
So you're kind of getting ahead of us a little bit.
I like to do that, but.
Well, what about the information that was presented by the Highway Patrol here on the fees that are collected? We had, well, one thing that's kind of, I think raises kind of a question to us is that there are only a few counties that submit funds to the Highway Patrol from these extraordinary road use cash receipts. And the state treasurer doesn't get any money from the other counties. So what's happening in those counties?
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer with 100% certainty, but I can tell you most counties do not have a functioning overweight permit operation. The 17 counties in the western part have an overweight permitting structure, and they have a more uniformed approach, but most counties do not, quite frankly, for two reasons. One, the sheriff's office does not have the capability of buying scales, which are extremely expensive. So they do rely on the Highway Patrol, but if the Highway Patrol is busy or reassigned to the western part of the state, there really is no functioning program. The concept has always been that the locals try to pool resources to put together a unified approach, but that hasn't happened uniformly. So for the most part, the counties that are not remitting money, I would wager a guess that they just don't have an operating program.
Including the 17 oil-producing counties you mentioned?
The 17 oil-producing counties with their specific program should be remitting the overweight use fees to the Highway Patrol, which in turn gets turned over to the treasurer's office.
Well, did you see that one-page handout? I don't see, I see Montreal County Sheriff's Department submitted some funds for 2010, but not for 2011, and then looks like all the other counties listed are not any of those 17.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, what I was looking at was the 2,000 overloads by counties and roadway on the multi-page handout.
I think maybe what you need to look at is the one-page handout. Make sure you get it there. The multi-page one for the 3 years, I think the explanation there was all those assessments were made by the Highway Patrol.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm not sure exactly how that works. I would suggest that the Highway Patrol actually does do the overweight enforcement on the county road structure, even on those 17 counties. So I'm not sure if there's an independent assessment process being done by those 17 counties. Now, we're not involved in that program. I know there, Brady Pelton is here with the Oil and Gas Association. Maybe he has better insight. But what I would suggest is that the listing of the money on the 2011 overload on the multi-page encompasses what they're doing on those 17 counties.
And would it be possible for you to find out if these other counties that aren't listed on this one-page handout are collecting any kind of extraordinary road use fees?
I'd be happy to dig into that, yep.
And so that we can, maybe at the next meeting, and I don't know when that's going to be, but if you could come back and tell us what you've found out, Because it seems like certainly, you know, particularly in the oil-producing counties, where it's just where a huge percentage of the overload fees being collected by the highway patrol are occurring, if the counties are also doing something, I guess I'd be interested to know that as part of the full picture here.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to do that. The thing I'd leave you with is the 2011 on the multi-page would be consistent with how, when I've talked to county folks, that they've been utilizing the highway patrol to send in that money. But I would be happy to dig in and ask the other counties what they're doing.
Okay, thank you. And maybe you could step back up again after we've had the presentation on the bill and give us...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
In regards to the extraordinary use cash receipts from one of the 17 oil and gas producing counties, I can attest that we don't have scales in Slope County, so there would be no receipts by the Slope County treasurer going to the highway patrol, to go into the highway fund. What we do is we rely on the permitting system that we have with the oil and gas producing counties to get ahead of that and make it as user-friendly as possible so we don't have those extraordinary weights on our roads. And I can't speak to the other 16, but I'd be pretty confident in saying most of them don't have the ability to weigh these overweight permits. We call on the highway patrol to help us with that.
Okay, thank you. Well, I think what we'll do is move on to the next item on the agenda then and ask Mr. Bjornson to give us an explanation of the bill draft relating to the distribution of extraordinary road use fees.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, in your packet there should be a bill draft on the top, 13.0036.01000. This was requested at the last meeting after some discussion on this issue and review and discussion of the bill that was introduced and not passed in the 2011 legislative session. And the request was to essentially prepare that bill draft again, but provide that the money be used in counties for the support of the county road system. So if you look at section one of the bill draft, it provides that for violations on an interstate or a state highway, the monies must be deposited with the state treasurer to be credited to the state highway fund. Extraordinary road fee use fees for a violation that did not occur on an interstate or a state highway must be deposited in the county general fund in the county of the violation and used for the support of the county road system. Now that was the difference from the 2011 bill. It didn't include the part about for the support of the county road system, use for the support of the county road system. If you go on to page two, again, the second section of the bill, the change is to make this consistent is in essentially line eight. From the proceeds of, this is for, if there is a confiscation of a vehicle and there's proceeds from a sale, the sale proceeds, if it's not on an interstate or a state highway, again, are to be deposited in the county general fund and used for only for county road purposes. Section 3 is something new that wasn't in the 2011 bill, and this is in response to the chairman's request that we look at the South Dakota law and put in a requirement that the director of the Department of Transportation conducts semi-annual reviews of the performance of each county and the enforcement of oversize and overweight vehicle regulations. If the director finds that the county's enforcement is unsatisfactory, the director is required to notify the Board of County Commissioners of the county of any deficiency in enforcement. If there's a second deficiency found, the director shall notify the county of the deficiency and request the state treasurer to withhold monthly distributions of funds from the state highway tax distribution fund to the county until the county has submitted to the director a written plan for correcting any deficiency identified by the director. In conducting the reviews, there's certain factors that would be reviewed, and those are on the top of page 3. Whether the county has requested that the highway patrol assist in enforcement of the county's size and road limits. And I think the statistics provided in that handout earlier would give you some indication of some counties that where the highway patrol has been significantly more active than other counties. Secondly, the diligence of the county enforcing size and road limits, particularly with respect to habitual offenders. Whether the county is enforcing size and road limits appropriately and fairly, and any other factors that, that might be appropriate after consultation with interested parties such as sheriffs, county commissioners, state's attorneys, county highway superintendents, and the highway patrol. Well, this is, as I said, essentially similar to what South Dakota law provides right now, and I believe at the last meeting we did a review a little bit of what South Dakota, Montana, and Minnesota have in their law. Section 4 is just a exception put into the highway tax distribution fund language that the, you know, the language provides for how the funds are to be distributed. We put the exception in there that says you know, that allows the state treasurer to withhold distributions under Section 3 if these conditions aren't met, so we need to just put an exception in there. Section 5, as requested by the chairman at the last meeting, was to make this effective for 4 years and then sunset it, so you have some opportunity to see how this this system would work, and then have the opportunity for review if the legislative assembly determines that they want to continue it. Mr. Chairman, that's I guess all I have for you. I'll try and answer any questions.
I have a question on Section 3 in use of the words like on line 22, word unsatisfactory, line 24, deficient. Are there any kind of standards that South Dakota looks at to make those kind of determinations? There it seems to be pretty subjective.
Mr. Chairman, I can't disagree that it does appear subjective, and I think the South Dakota law was equally or more subjective. There really were no guidelines that I could find that addressed that in any way. It was simply if there was a belief that the counties weren't diligent in enforcing it, that the director there could make those changes. And as I recall, I put in here basically a second chance that there had to be two findings of unsatisfactory enforcement or a review, and I don't think South Dakota had a second opportunity as this does.
And that's the language on line 24 in the following semiannual review?
Yeah, that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And I think one of the concerns that I heard expressed previously was that there might be an abuse of the collection of these fees, or perceived abuse anyway, by some counties with enforcement people sort of lying in wait to catch people coming in that they know where they're going to be, and that was, seems to me that was a concern, and the way you've just expressed it, but not diligent enough in enforcing, was sort of the opposite. So I'm not sure, and I know the those four factors that are listed on page 3 of the bill, the diligence of the county, I guess you could read that both ways. I think the concern was the county might be too diligent. Do any members of the commission have questions about the language of this bill draft? Well, seeing none, let's move on then to comments by other interested persons. Mr. Burst, do you have some comments on this? Now we'll talk about the bill draft.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry to get ahead of you. Mr. Chairman, again, my name is Aaron Burst with the Association of Counties. I'm legal counsel for the Association of Counties, and in my previous life, I actually prosecuted these type of cases in Cass County, North Dakota. Regarding the bill draft itself, with the Association of Counties has always been supportive of, again, the concept that if there is a local political subdivision that has been harmed by an overweight vehicle, the extraordinary use fees would go back to that local political subdivision for specific purposes of planting that money back into the road structure. That's been our support. I think this bill does that with the bottom of page one. I think that clarifies that. Last session, as you know, and Mr. Bjornson has gone through with you, this was originally what we supported, but it got changed just to the permitting structure allowed to stay in the political subdivision's hands. We think it's also important the extraordinary use fees stay in the political subdivision's hands. With regard to any type of review, auditing, any oversight by the Department of Transportation, Highway Patrol, this legislative body, we would support that concept too. I'd be happy to take any questions. I know it's a complicated issue when you're talking permit fees, overuse fees, and fines. The fines has never been a concern for the counties because they never received those dollars. The $100 fine that's assessed and $20 penalty all goes to the school trust fund, so by constitution. So we have always only been concerned with the user fees.
Any questions for Mr. Burst? Well, you're getting off easy.
Yeah, I guess. I'd be more, Mr. Chairman, I will follow up on those questions you asked of me and get back to you and the committee. If there is any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them anytime.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Other persons wanting to comment on this bill draft?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Clark. I represent North Dakota Farm Bureau, and I guess I don't have a whole lot to add from what we said last time. We are the organization that's concerned about overzealous enforcement. And I guess as I look at the one-page handout, there haven't been a whole lot of enforcement actions. They have the opportunity to do it now. And I guess I have to look at it and say, if it's not broke, don't fix it. Now, certainly recognize that the western part of the state has a different issue, and if it's truly about roads and destruction of roads, I would have thought that the counties in the oil-producing counties would have been doing something about enforcement on township and county roads. So. But primarily, I do want to talk about Section 3 on page 2, and Mr. Chairman, appreciate your comments earlier that we would have some problem with Section 2. We think it does exactly, or Section 3, I'm sorry, does exactly the opposite of what our concerns were. So that's...
I think what maybe we're looking at is some language in Section 3 that would maybe provide a little more objective standards as to what this review is to consist of and what deficiencies might consist of.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's that would be a direction to start with. I have some research I would like to do. I don't have it. I have not completed it. But I think I heard, this is just what I heard on the news one day about, you're aware that Barnes and Stetson County went together to do an enforcement program and buy scales and that sort of thing. In the first week they were in operation, they, I don't remember, stopped five trucks, bing, 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 and some were fine, some were not overweight, and it would be interesting to know how that's worked in those particular counties.
Do you know when that started?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I can't tell you, but it would have been shortly after the last, end of the last session, because that's when they were talking about it.
Okay, so it would have been in 2011?
I believe so. But folks in the Association of Counties might be able to answer that.
Any questions from the commission for Ms. Clark?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Rea.
I have a question. How do you define overzealous enforcement?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Rea, I guess some examples I gave last meeting where at one of the beet plants, the trucks would come in and they were perfectly legal at 105.5. But as soon as they pulled off and went over to the plant, they weren't, and the enforcement was sitting right there. I also heard from one of our members that it was happening at a local elevator as well.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Go ahead.
How do we draft a bill that says we want enforcement but not too much enforcement? I mean, if someone is violating the law, shouldn't they be held accountable for it?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Rea, I understand the dilemma, and that's been our issue since the beginning here, that we don't think this is about protecting roads. It's about a revenue source for counties. Unfortunately, but...
Well, I think we're trying to make an effort in the Section 3 to have some oversight, and maybe this needs a little refinement yet, but what about the main, the other part of the bill where the funds are to be deposited in the County General Fund for county road purposes? Do you have any comments on that part of it?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would say that I like the part that if it's a state or interstate road, it would go to the state highway fund. We understand that it would be good to have these go to the county, but at the same time, feel like that's what creates the overzealous part of it.
Did you have have you had an opportunity to look at the handout from the Highway Patrol here on the 3 years of overload, extraordinary overload overload fees? And just, it really stands out that in a couple of counties in 2011, like Williams County on county roads, was $447,000 out of a total of $1.9 million. That's almost 25% of the whole state was in one county on county roads. It sort of sounds like there's a potential there for a lot of damage to county roads if that's the kind of overloads that are being that are occurring on those county roads, and wouldn't it kind of make sense that the county gets some money back from this to help repair those roads?
Mr. Chairman, certainly we understand the dilemma in the oil patch, and on the face of it, if we didn't have to deal with the concerns we have about the overzealous to generate dollars, we wouldn't be standing here. But without question, we can understand the situation in the oil patch. I do find it interesting on the one page handout that, frankly, I'm surprised there aren't more counties on there. And I share your, question about particularly the oil counties that are not on, this list. And I suspect that, you're right. They don't have, their own scales.
Where were these beat?
But if they're concerned about the, if the real concern is about the roads, they would be enforcing without remuneration because they're not, I'm sorry, I mean, your question is where are the beat counties?
Oh, like I see Cass County listed on this one-page handout, but I don't see other.
Mr. Chairman, if I can step away for just a moment because I didn't bring my. Mr. Chairman, it would be Cass, Grand Forks, Walsh, Trail. And you can see, well, I'll go to 2011, I guess. Cass has had a number. Trail has had some. Pembina would be a beat county. Where's Richmond? Richmond.
Excuse me, but are you looking on that multi-page handout now?
Yes, I am, and I'm.
These are all assessments by the Highway Patrol.
Correct.
Not by.
But, oh, your question was on here?
Yeah, on the one by the local law enforcement or road enforcement personnel.
Cass.
The one I see there of those that you mentioned is Cass.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
Cass.
That kind of leaves a question because we know it's not going to the state treasurer if they are collecting something. Yeah.
And Dickey, I don't know what the travel route is, but the oh, I'm losing my mind here. The ADM plant down there might be some of that. I can't tell you what. Other businesses might be there. Well, I take that back. Dickey might be the when the Bobcat plant was there too. Hmm. Might be some of that.
I guess what I'm sort of getting at is if we're concerned about overzealous enforcement and we really have no evidence that there's been any, well, is this really a concern that we should be addressing?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, that is our concern because there hasn't been very many. But if they're going to get the money, they will enforce. I think we had testimony to that effect during the session on the first bill. There was a county that said that.
Well,
about money.
One thing that I think we'd like you to do is go back to your organization and maybe take a close look at the Section 3 of this bill, and if you've got some ideas on how this could be revised in some way, if you could bring those comments back to our next meeting, because we'll at least have one more on this bill draft. I don't know when that's going to be, but.
Mr. Chairman, absolutely.
Well, we certainly are
happy to do that.
Are looking for input on this. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Other comments on the bill draft?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Wade Inget. I'm Montreal County State Attorney. I'm not actually, didn't come down here for this. I'm actually going to speak a little bit later, but I just wanted to kind of put the 2 cents worth in for Montreal County on the overweight. I see we're listed on the 2011 overloads, and you can also see Montreal County being listed on the North Dakota Highway Patrol handout that was given here as well. I want to highlight, I guess, a couple things. First of all, under the existing law, if a law enforcement officer in Montreal County, we don't have our own scales, we're going that direction. If we see an overload or suspected overload, we call the Highway Patrol. Highway Patrol comes out, does the all of the weights, does the calculations, and then turns the matter over to our office for prosecution as a civil matter. Any of those funds that would be then forfeited through the process, either through a voluntary matter or actually going through the entire hearing, would then be sent to the state through our clerk's office. The one that kind of jumps out at you, I think, in the North Dakota Highway Patrol, one was the $32,000 matter that we had. And actually what that was a rig move. They decided not to completely tear down the rig. And what they did is they took two semis and they put them back to back. So the front one was going forward and the one on the back was backing, and they were moving it from site to site. The chief deputy happened to actually be driving out to another situation that he was going to check on, had to look down and realize that there hadn't been a permit through his office for an overweight application, went down and checked, and the guy just said, well, we're just going a little ways. And obviously, the condition of our township and county roads, especially in the last 2 years, have deteriorated greatly just because of the additional oil traffic. These roads were basically, especially the township roads, were what we call mucking roads, where they, in the 40s with WPA, they basically took the, if you want to say, the stuff on the side and just rolled it up onto the top and created a roadbed. It has been extremely affected by this oil traffic, and that now we are getting roads that, you know, there isn't a good base if you were going to build it. So they're having to be rebuilt completely from the ground up. The $32,000 we used, we had great assistance from the Highway Patrol. In fact, if you look at all of the ones that show up from Montreal County, those are Highway Patrol assistance cases, every one of them. And they have been excellent to work with. They have given me as a prosecutor the information that I've needed on a timely basis. Yes, the county would like to have a part of that, those funds, obviously, because the analogy that I made with the Highway Patrol and with the state when I was talking to them was, when we have drug bust money, you know, we try to do an agreement where we go so much local, so much, you know, to the state, whatever. And although at the present time the statute doesn't allow for that at all, there's no agreements that we can enter into which would be then all of a sudden we're able to overcome what the statute said has to be done with the money. So I do think that this is a good start. I realize that it's not going to be the absolute perfect situation in every situation, but it's a start. And I really don't think that the counties, when we're looking at this, especially Montreal County, we're not going to be out there with our scales looking for things. Obviously, the ones that you see here from Montreal County are obvious ones. And I can tell you the other situations that we have. That one was a rig move. The other one is when they move scrapers, huge scrapers that they're using for earthwork. Those, again, our deputies are given a listing of all the permits that have been applied for so that they have an idea, or else they'll call in to verify that there has been a permit issued for that move. If there hasn't, they stop them and then they weigh them. And the $32,000 one, I think we've had $17,000, you know, all the way down to $5,000 that we've had with overweight. So I can't really say that it's overzealous prosecution. We've got enough to do in rural country without going out and looking for these things too. So those are just my comments off the cuff, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if there's any questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Engett? Seeing none, thank you very much. Other comments from anyone? Any commission discussion on this bill draft? So I think what we'll do is, now we have, just to kind of review the requirement for submitting a bill, we have to consider this twice. So this will be considered our first, this will be our first consideration of this bill draft, and at a subsequent meeting, we'll also consider it again, and maybe we'll have two more meetings. I'm not quite sure yet. Depends on how much work we have left to do.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Based off of the discussion that we've had, I'm under the assumption that somebody's going to look at Section 3 of the bill draft regarding making sure that it's a little more objective than some of the standards. Is that going to be the case?
Well, that's partially the duty of this commission.
Yeah.
To look at that. When the somebody is us.
Yeah. Well, I just didn't know if Legislative Council is going to be making any adjustments there yet or not. One of the things that I was wondering about is towards the end of subsection 1 of Section 3. It talks about how the state treasurer will withhold funds until a written plan for correcting any deficiency identified has been submitted to the director. Does any standards need to be in place as far as the way that I read this, I could see a county or just basically saying, well, here's plan, we will do better, and it's written, and we submit it, now we get our funds. Should there be anything that it's a plan that's satisfactory or deemed satisfactory by the director before they release the funds, or do they just release it upon the written submission of a plan?
That's a good question. Certainly, if you...
Because if I was in violation of it, I'd just take one piece of paper the day that it happened and say, we will do better, submit it. I can make the argument that it was a written plan for correcting the deficiencies.
So are you proposing that, say, to amend line 27 to say a satisfactory written plan?
I think that'd be... I think that could be a friendly amendment.
We have an amendment to the bill draft to add the word satisfactory before a written plan on line 27, page 2. Any discussion? I guess I should ask if there's a second to that motion to amend.
Second.
Okay, any discussion on that? All in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? No. Motion carries. So we'll put that word in there, satisfactory. Anyone else have any comments or proposed amendments?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question for clarification. Under subsection 3, the two terms that we're a little uncomfortable with, the unsatisfactory and any deficiency, is the plan to ask Legislative Council to draft some language that is more objective? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we certainly can do that. I guess Mr. Bjornson, I think, can look into that and try and come up with some language for the next meeting.
Okay.
But anyone on the commission's got any specific directions on that, it probably would be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, I will consult with with DOT to see that they have appropriate input into what they feel would be necessary to fit their requirements.
No. Has DOT received a copy of this bill draft?
Mr. Chairman, I did not get them involved at this point, but I know they need to have input on that.
They certainly may have some comments on the duty we're assigning here. Representative Hiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The whole Section 3 on this bill draft kind of bothers me because we didn't get this bill passed last session, and if we're just trying to tweak it a little bit so the counties can keep the fees or the fines, fees I guess, and the extraordinary use fees, I can see a lot of legislators having an issue with that whole Section 3. So if they don't like that, the whole thing will go down. And if we're trying to get the counties to keep their money, is what I thought we were trying to do, I think that Section 3 could be a big problem. But if everybody else likes it, that's fine. That's just my comment. It might be a really tough sale to try to get that through with Section 3 in there.
Okay.
if we were going to try to tiptoe this through again. Just my comment.
Okay, thank you. And I think the whole idea of Section 3 was to provide some kind of oversight to, so that there, from two standpoints, we don't want to have an abuse of the as referred to, overzealous enforcement at the local level, nor do we want the locals to be not doing anything. So, gotta, and I think that's the point of Section 3, is to provide some kind of oversight. And certainly, I guess you, we don't have to have that in there. This is just a bill draft. We can change it any way we want. But I think for now, maybe we ought to focus on trying to come up with some kind of objective standards, if we can, before we take out the whole section. See how that looks.
Mr. Chairman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Similar to what Representative Heller just stated regarding Section 3, I agree entirely that, I mean, we need to have some sort of oversight on this to prevent some abuse, but I do see some people taking issues with Section 3. So I know while we get the Highway Patrol or the DOT involved with it, since they're going to be playing a role within the oversight, would we be able to make sure that we can get some sort of assessment as to whether or not these semi-annual reviews are going to result in any additional FTEs being requested by DOT? Because if they start to request additional FTEs in order to handle with the review process, and that, again, could cause a hurdle. So it'd be good to know that going into it.
Well, that's certainly something to consider, and I guess we'll ask maybe that DOT can come to our next meeting and comment on this bill draft, which they apparently haven't seen yet, so... Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I think it's my understanding, and of course I was not on a committee that looked at this in the last session, but it is my recollection that one of the reasons this bill failed was a concern about overzealous enforcement. And this Section 3 is intended to look at some kind of oversight so that doesn't happen.
And Mr. Chairman, I completely agree with that. And that, I mean, having the oversight in order to make sure that we don't have some of the overzealous enforcement is definitely a good idea and needed. Just when we do get the DOT involved, if we can make sure that the request also shows about if there's any need for additional FTEs, just so we have all the information going forward before we create that oversight, might be beneficial.
Stand at ease for a minute.
Is there a call in the room?
Any other discussion from the commission members? Okay, let's move on to the next agenda item then. Comments from interested persons regarding the appropriateness of the $100 fine for overweight vehicle violations. Anyone wish to comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Burst of the Association of Counties. I was specifically requested to address this issue, so I'm doing so. As I mentioned in my previous remarks, the county government has no real dog in this fight in terms of where those dollars go. The fines have to go to the school trust fund. What I will say is, reviewing all of the fines through our whole region, the $100 is quite low. You could say that for just about any traffic violation, though, in the state of North Dakota. What I will also say, though, with regard to overweight, overuse fees, the $100 is minimal concern. The real concern is the civil penalties. If that tells you anything about if people are worried about the effect of the fine, the $100 is meaningless.
Questions for Mr. Burst? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other comments regarding this subject? Any commission discussion on that subject? Is $100 fine, is that Too high, too low, just right, leave it alone? What do you think? All right, not hearing anybody. We'll just move on to the next subject and presentation by Legislative Council staff of a bill draft relating to immunity during disaster response.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, this is in response to issues presented at the last meeting with respect to immunity provisions under Chapter 37-17.1 of the Century Code. And we prepared this draft at the request of the commission, and the chairman had provided some guidelines for us to work with in preparing this draft at the last meeting. Section 1, as you recall, there was some discussion that regarding compensation for property damage when piece of property, say a building was commandeered for use during a disaster, and there was immunity, or there needed to be destruction, or the order had to come from the governor for the use of the property or destruction of the property if there was going to be compensation provided. And the comments were that maybe the order for the use of the destruction coming from the governor was a bit too stringent, and that it only had to be appropriate action taken in the by the entity or the individual making that order for the destruction. So the language on line 9 takes out the provision that the use of the destruction had to be ordered by the governor. There's a chain of command, and emergency management is that chain of command probably, in this case, would end with emergency management, and the governor wouldn't be directly making that order. So that language is taken out. So compensation may be available in cases if this were to pass, where the appropriate procedures are followed, but the order wouldn't have had to have come from the governor. Section 2 deals with immunity provisions, and again, there was discussion that there's basically a blanket immunity for state and political subdivisions under certain disaster emergency circumstances. And the request was is to limit it to individuals. So on line 11, you'll see that state, county, and city was taken out. There's still protection for emergency workers, employees of federal agencies, and any individual that provides services during the emergency response. If you turn over to page 2, that's just the remainder of the section is unchanged, so that the change is just limited to the individual immunity for people that are providing emergency response. Section 3, there was discussion during the meeting about private liability. As I recall, the discussion was revolved around when a building is put to use for a private building, a privately owned building is put to use in some respect in an emergency response, and there was basically total immunity for that building owner, and the request was to limit that to a certain extent. So if you see on line 18 and line 19, the immunity is limited to wouldn't be available in cases of gross negligence. Section 4 of the bill deals with expenses paid for the state disaster relief fund, and under the current law, the use of that fund is relatively limited, and the request was to expand the use to allow payment of any expenses that are allowed under Chapter 37-17. So, for instance, the compensation for, if you look on, in Section 1, the compensation for some property use or property damage could be allowed now under the state disaster relief funds. So there will be a source to pay some of the compensation that could be required or authorized under this chapter, including perhaps some instances of liability, although that would probably be covered by insurance in some cases. But this would open up the use of the disaster relief fund to anything, any type of payment authorized under the chapter that deals with disaster relief and disaster mitigation.
Thank you. Well, as I recall a previous testimony that we had, particularly on starting with Section 1, it was my recollection that because of the language in there that we're deleting, there has never, ever been a situation that had arose where the governor himself specifically and personally said, take this building or do whatever. And that may have happened, but the way it's interpreted here is it had to be the governor who actually says that and not some other person. So I think that the problem was is that whole provision relating to compensation from the state disaster relief fund in those situations seemed to fail of its essential purpose in that there was no way that anyone was ever going to get compensated for a taking of their property like this unless the governor was standing there and said, do it. And so that seemed to me, at least, to be a little bit extreme, and that's kind of the reason why we struck that language. There certainly could be other cases, I think, where we're operating during a disaster and property can be commandeered or used in the management of that disaster, like we saw happen in Minot, for example, without the governor having to be there personally saying it's okay to go wreck that house in order to put up a dike. And of course, the governor wasn't there in person saying that, so this section didn't apply. And I guess I'm talking about situations that actually happened in the Minot flood. Are there any comments from interested persons on the bill draft that we have before us now? Any discussion by members of the commission on this bill draft? Positive or negative comments?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Rhea,
Section 3, lines 18 and 19, I don't know if there might be some confusion with the language that says except in a case of gross negligence and then for negligently causing the death, two different standards. And I think I know what we're trying to say there, but we're talking gross negligence and then 2 words later we're talking about negligence. And I'm wondering if that wouldn't lead to some confusion.
Maybe the clause, except in the case of no gross negligence, should come at the end of the sentence.
Or except in the case of gross negligence for causing the death of, and eliminate the word negligently on line 19.
Okay. Not solely liable except in the case of gross negligence for causing the death of, etc.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you proposing that as an amendment?
Yes.
Delete the word negligently on line 20, page 2?
Right. Yes.
Is there a motion?
Yes.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried. So we'll delete the word negligently off of page 2, line 19. Other comments or motions?
We
Okay, well, seeing none, then I guess we'll ask council to bring back a second draft of this bill with that one change for our next meeting for further consideration. And according to my watch, it's 10:14. We've got 1 minute until we're supposed to take a break. I think we'll just break early. Come back at 10:30. The next item on our agenda, we're going to be talking about group housing regulation, and we have some people here to comment on that. First, Mr. Gene Burrish, or is it Burrish? I'm not sure which way you pronounce that.
In Bismarck, it's Burrish, and Dickinson, it's Burrish. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Gene Burrish. I work with the Roosevelt Custer Regional Council in Dickinson. We provide technical assistance to the 8 southwestern counties in the state. We've been working with planning and zoning and comprehensive plans or giving assistance to the local communities and counties for 4 years now. We've worked with all 8 counties in the region and a number of cities. Currently, we are working in assisting 4 counties and 5 communities with updating of comprehensive plans and zoning ordinances. And next week, we're taking on the challenge of working with McKinsey County in developing their initial zoning ordinance. Group housing is, of course, one of the issues that we deal with each of the communities and with each of the counties. You know, whether you call it group housing or crew camps or crew housing facilities or temporary workforce housing, it's an issue. We're working with the benefit of hindsight. The issue is just starting to be an issue in southwest North Dakota. We have the benefit of experience of the northwest counties, and you'll hear some of the horror stories, I suppose, after I'm up here. We're trying to fashion an effective and enforceable code ordinance or code provisions dealing with group housing, and it's difficult to do. All of the communities, all of the counties recognize the need for some sort of group housing. The workers in the oil field have to have some place to live. Crew housing, group housing relieves some of the pressure on the regular housing market and on the rental markets. And we see it as a way of avoiding what we call the crowding out effect because of the rising housing prices and the rental prices. We're faced with the circumstance where the locals are forced to leave the community because they can no longer afford housing. So everybody thinks it's good, but it has its problems. And those, of course, deal mostly with the fear of the community of the impacts they'll suffer because of group housing. You have a small community, 400 or 500 people, and all of a sudden you have a 1,000 man camp in outside the community or within the community. It causes a lot of changes. But basically, as far as the small communities go, they do not have the infrastructure that would allow for group housing within their community. Water and sewer, of course, is a big problem. But in trying to fashion a workable code provision, over the last couple of years and looking at it before we're actually hit with the problem, we see 2 major problems. One, the first is an actual definition of what group housing is. Now, the code has a provision, you know, defining crew housing facilities, but that's really from a taxing perspective. Gives direction to a county or community what they can tax as real estate and what they can't. Crew housing, they can't. It provides for a system of assessing a fee for the costs and services given to a group housing facility. We look at it from the perspective of two types of group housing. One, a closed housing situation, and one, an open housing. A closed housing we define as a crew housing facility or a work camp, which is leased to an employer, and only the employees of that employer or employers can live in that facility. And those facilities generally provide not only lodging, they generally also provide food services, laundry services, and recreational services. Those are the big companies. Those are your Target Logistics, your ATCOs. They handle the 600 to several thousand man camps. Those are generally well run, and those don't cause a terrible number of problems for the local jurisdictions. The other type of housing, and ones we're trying to avoid in southwest North Dakota, is what we call the open camps. Those are the small operations, two, three RVs behind the barn over the hill, literally, in a shelter belt or on farmsteads. Those are not well regulated. Those are not, or should be, but oftentimes aren't subject to the state health regulations. So we try to fashion a provision that discourages those types of man camps. There is some equivocation, though, among the jurisdictions. A lot of the jurisdictions don't see why a local person, farmer or rancher, can't make a little bit of money off of the oil boom like everybody else and put two or three mobile homes or two or three RV camps, or RVs, you know, on their property and hook up to their water system. It's the open crew camps that we feel cause the problems. There's health issues. There's safety issues, and there's emergency management issues. A lot of times with the small camps, the law enforcement and medical providers have difficulty locating a particular place when a call comes in because there aren't regulations as to identification addresses and things of that sort. So that's the first thing we see as a major problem, is we would like to see a more restrictive definition, or a restrictive definition, of what exactly a man camp is or group housing is and how it's going to be regulated. That would help us in drafting provisions to try to eliminate the smaller open camps. The second big issue is enforcement. Not only the small communities, but the counties, most of them, probably with the exception of Stark County in southwestern North Dakota, do not have the personnel or the expertise to enforce any kind of a man camp provision. There are no building inspectors in southwest North Dakota other than in Stark County. There's no code enforcers. There's simply not the money available to hire them if you can find them, and so enforcement is a major issue. What we've been looking at through the regional council, we've been attempting to obtain grant funds from various organizations to look at kind of a circuit rider type system to hire, whether it be an engineer or a code inspector or a building inspector, on a regional basis, to help out the smaller communities and the smaller counties, not in terms of area, but in terms of population. So far, we've been unsuccessful, but we see that as a real issue. I think Mr. Engit, who will talk after me, can give you some experiences that Montreal County's had with enforcement. And we have another problem in southwest North Dakota, and that's the availability of legal staff to pursue some of these issues. Mr. Oradnick knows that at the end of the month, you know, his county and Bowman County won't have a state's attorney. Their state's attorney resigned, and it's not easy in the small counties to find a replacement even on a temporary basis. And it's not practical to expect a replacement state's attorney from Dickinson to handle the day-to-day enforcement issues involved with zoning, and particularly the issues presented when you're dealing with man camps. Now, we're lucky to this point. Dunn County has some experience with man camps. They're dealing with the construction of or permit applications for approximately 2,000 beds. The other counties, Stark and Golden Valley County, have had some interest. Stark County has a few closed camps, company camps, particularly in the Belfield area. But there's some pressure at this point because of the moratoriums declared by Montreal and Williams County on the issuance of new man camp permits. Dickinson's negotiating at this point for a 3,000 man camp. So, you know, it's coming. We're trying to address the problem, you know, before it hits us, but we see as the major issues, we need a stricter definition, one that's enforceable, and we need help with enforcement. And that's a difficult one. But I guess, you know, the bottom line is none of the communities are trying to prohibit it. If they could accommodate it, they would. You know, there's a lot of money in man camps. There's a lot of money to be made too if you're running a man camp. Some of the expenses can be borne by the developers of the man camps, but not all. And I guess that's all I have to say, unless you have questions.
I guess the question I had initially is on your comment that you'd like to see a more restrictive definition. Are you talking about in, like, in North Dakota state law, or
yes.
Where are you talking?
Yes.
The one that you referred to for tax purposes, do you have the citation for that?
Do you know that offhand, Wade? I know it references the definitions of real estate, and it references the definition of mobile homes, because real estate and mobile homes are taxed differently from skid units and man camp provisions. I can't off the top of my head give you the provision.
Do you have any suggestions on what the definition should be? Let's say, for example, if we were, as this commission, to have a bill draft that contained a definition, what should that definition be?
We would like, if we had our preference, we would like the definition of a man camp limited. I don't have a problem with how they define crew housing, but we would like it, that portion of the definition, attached to a closed system where you don't have crew camps or group housing open to the public like a motel, but rather a system where you have a manager or a management company operating it for a particular employer. Those are the ones that can be controlled. Those are the ones that are well operated generally, and those provide or result in less problems for law enforcement and emergency management personnel. I don't have a specific definition, but we would rather deal with those than the whole gamut.
I guess I'm kind of also wondering as to, you know, where, if we did have a definition in state law, where would we put that definition and why would we put it there?
I would suspect it would be in the same provision that the crew housing definition comes in.
But that was for tax reasons, you said.
Well, that was the statute that said communities, counties couldn't tax crew housing facilities as real property, except they could. It did allow the jurisdictions to assess a fee to recoup the expenses involved with road maintenance, what have you, with infrastructure related to or the services granted to the facilities.
And are you suggesting that, they should have the ability to tax those facilities?
No. We don't quibble with the tax aspect of it. The permit fee, that's wide open. I mean, all the statute says is it should be related to the actual services rendered to the companies, but they, you know, they range from so much a bed to so much per square foot. Dickinson's is the highest I've seen, that's $400 a bed. You know, you take a 3,000 man camp at $400 a bed, that's quite a sizable sum. Dickinson also requires, they use it as a development tool, also requires the annexation of the property and requires the developer to install all the infrastructure, the streets, curb, gutter, and water and sewer. They hook up to the city system, but you know, that's an expensive operation. That in itself, you know, eliminates any of the small camps. But
well,
pardon me?
Oh, excuse me. We just looked up that we have a chapter 5702.4 on crew housing permit fees. Is that the one you're referring
to? Yes.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Burrish from the members of the commission? Representative Hiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So these enclosed campuses or man camps, do the companies that have them have their own people on site to manage like rowdiness, or if someone isn't a good tenant, do they kick them out, or how does that work?
It depends. There's, I suppose, a couple kinds of closed camps. Example, in Belfield, Paramount Grilling has a camp for its employees on its property. Only its employees can live there, and yes, they have 24-hour management on site, and they take care of everything. The other type of a closed man camp would, as an example, would be a man camp put up by Target Logistics, as an example. Those are usually larger. They have their own management, 24-hour services. They have security, well controlled. It's the other ones that cause the problem.
I think one of the concerns that we heard addressed at a previous meeting was that there was difficulty for, in case of emergency services or medical services or law enforcement services or 911, to identify where that person might be, or if you have a 1,000 or 2,000 person man camp, which is, you know, a pretty good sized city, that how do you find the person if for emergency reasons if there's an emergency?
Well, crew camps are temporary workforce housing, generally are conditional uses under zoning ordinances, and as a conditional use, the zoning board, county commission, can attach any reasonable requirement or condition. I think we did provide you with a number of ordinances from the different jurisdictions, and that generally is one of the requirements or the conditions attached to granting a permit, is that they provide a plan to the jurisdiction, identifying how they will, I suppose, in the circumstances, identify a location of a particular person. Most of the closed camps require an outside identification or numbering system for the units in the camp, whether it's a skid unit or RV park or what have you. Also, most of the ordinances, actually all of them that I've seen, require at least weekly update to local law enforcement as to the names of each individual in the camp and to the unit that individual is located. Two purposes for that. One is for emergency management reasons, so they can find somebody in the case of an emergency. And the other is it generally gives law enforcement the opportunity to do a background check if there's anybody in the camp that's wanted for whatever reason, or for sex offenders and things of that sort. That's a condition. Mm-hmm. They can attach whatever condition you want as long as it's reasonable.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Other questions from Mr. Burrish?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If you want these closed camps defined and regulated, and so that you can deal, what's to happen with the open camps that you describe? Is there to be no, do you depend on whatever rules and regulations that local entities have to enforce health and other concerns about those things?
Health concerns should be enforced by the state. I think it's one of the problems we see. The state doesn't have the capacity at this point, or the state health department, to make all the health inspections that are necessary. I guess it would depend how the statute would define the term. If it leaves the open camps, if it doesn't address open camps, then I suppose, yes, that would be open to local enforcement. But I guess what we're trying to do is avoid that completely. And you can prohibit them on a local basis, and you can prohibit them on through a zoning ordinance or a regular county ordinance. The problem is the enforcement. You know, how do you get them out of there? How do you prevent them from locating in a particular place to begin with?
And you had said you were going to be working with McKenzie County on...
Well, McKenzie County is the only county in the state that doesn't have a zoning ordinance. And they have voted to initiate the process to adopt an ordinance. So hopefully when we're done, it'll be a challenge, but when we're done, there will be any counties in the state that don't have a zoning ordinance or a comprehensive plan. They don't have a comprehensive plan either.
And in McKenzie County, then, they have crew camps already, as I understand it, that are not regulated, apparently.
They have no regulations with regard to land uses. Watford City has a zoning ordinance, so Watford City and its extraterritorial area is subject to zoning at this point, but otherwise, no. Whatever there is there, they would be grandfathered in. It would be a non-conforming use. And so you have to start someplace. So you start at point A, and from that point forward, or after the adoption of a zoning ordinance, those rules would apply. But it doesn't cure past sins.
Now, I recall a thing from the zoning called the amortization of nonconforming uses. And as I recall it, the idea there was to recognize that a nonconforming use can't simply be zoned out of existence, but to have to give them a period of time to come into compliance, which is the amortization factor based on numbers of years or something to that effect. Are you looking at anything like that?
Well, we haven't started with them, but for most of the zoning ordinances that we've worked with, we do have a provision. First of all, after a period of non-use of a non-complying use, whether it be a year, 2 years, whatever, it loses that status and then would have to comply with the current zoning law. Or there's also provisions that if the property that the use is subject to is damaged to a particular degree, 50% or more, or improved 50% or more of its value, then it loses its non-conforming status and would have to comply with the existing zoning district ordinance at that point.
Okay.
I don't believe we can, zoning controls uses, I don't believe we can, I could be wrong, we give no legal opinions. I don't believe that you can amortize the use and the non-use. I don't know that that's...
Okay, well, maybe your legal counsel can research a law review article that I wrote about 30 years ago on that subject, which shows that you can do it.
I stand corrected.
Other questions or comments from Mr. Burrish? Thank you very much, Mr. Burrish.
Thank you.
And Next, we have comments from Mr. Don Longmire and Wayne Ingott regarding group housing regulation.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm going to speak rather fast. I'm already out of my time. I'm the Montreal County Zoning Administrator, Planner, and Disaster Emergency Coordinator. I wear three hats. One of the things that Montreal County has experienced is an explosion of man camps. And just to give you an example, the population in Montreal County, according to the latest census, was approximately 8,000. I would estimate we have between 3,000 and 4,000 temporary beds over and above that. We have the cities of Newtown, Stanley, and Partial as our top three cities as far as population. The next 10 communities are all man camps. Bringing up the bottom are our communities of Plaza, Ross, and White Earth because of numbers. Now, one of the things that we've instituted in Montreal County is on September 26, 2011, we instituted an 18-month moratorium on any man camps, temporary camps, RV camps, or mobile home parks. Reason for this being is the infrastructure can't catch up. It's not only the sewer and the water. We're waiting on the water coming from Williston to the Ray Tioga plant that will then come on into Stanley, because Stanley already gets its water from the Ray Tioga water plant. We're also running into sewage problems, and you've probably read about it in the paper. These man camps generate an overall city's worth amount of sewage. The other thing is we have at this time approximately 30 rigs driven in Montreal County. Those 30 rigs are also generating waste because there's sleeping quarters on those well sites housing those crews while they're working. And this septic is getting to be a very major issue. Another issue which Mr. Burrish alluded to is in Montreal County, we have basically operated under voluntary ambulance services for years. Due to the increase, the calls at the Stanley Community Hospital emergency room doubled from 2008 to 2009 and doubled from 2009 to 2010. One of the issues that comes up is that these people are well paid in the oil field, but some of them are subcontractors and should be carrying their own health insurance, which they don't. That presents a problem to the critical access hospitals in the area. It also presents a problem to the ambulance services, which have seen their calls probably triple and their unpaid bills increase exponentially. The city of Stanley Voluntary Ambulance Service is just, Ms. Drangett has just reviewed a contract. They will be contracting for paramedic services to help relieve the volunteers on the ambulance service who have some help during the day. City of Newtown currently has paramedic service. The paramedic service in the city of Stanley is going to cost them approximately $62,000 a year for 3 days a week service. So it's not only the sewer and the water, it's emergency structures, the emergency services. The other issue that's come up is multiple level houses or buildings in small rural communities. Stanley is scheduled to get 430 new beds in motels that have been approved by their city. A couple of those motels are four-story motels. For those of you from small communities, you realize that most of those ladders will make it to the second floor. The city of Stanley is going to have to look at an aerial unit. And those are types of expenses that these communities have not anticipated. The city of Newtown, about 3 years ago, did an expansion on their lagoon system and started on it, which has helped. They do take some septic a couple days a week. City of Stanley takes no septic. City of Partial takes septic a couple days a week. We have a company in Montreal County that is converting a 40-acre parcel of land into a three-cell lagoon system that's going to be privately owned and operated and will fall under the jurisdiction of the same as the city as far as the State Health Department. The State Health Department has been great to work with. I work with Keenan Bollinger. They're doing the best they can with the services they have, but the rapid explosion of this has been difficult on everybody. I would call your attention to the draft ordinances that Montreal County is coming up with, and a lot of those reasons are because of these things that were discussed earlier by Mr. Burrish. The ambulance services have a problem when they go into a man camp with unmarked facilities, and if you're responding to a cardiac situation, it makes it difficult.
law enforcement responding to everything from domestic violence to shots fired. Need to have a specific location to go to, and that's one of the reasons in ours, the site plan that they're submitted to the Planning and Zoning Board will require a map with unit numbers on them. The other issue that I'd like to call attention to in ours too is we have an issue with sex offenders. We had done this prior to the unfortunate incident in Sydney, but we're going to require or want to require that all residents of a temporary housing area have criminal background checks that are made available to law enforcement upon request. This is no different than if you rent an apartment down in Phoenix, Arizona. They're going to do a criminal background check on you before they rent you an apartment. With that, I would like to turn it over to Mr. Ingit for his comments, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, go ahead. Mr. Ingit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name again is Wade Ingit. I'm the Montreal County State's Attorney. It's amazing, and that's the only way that I can put it as to what's happened in Montreal County. I could have been standing here 5 years ago and we said we're seeing some activity up in Montreal County. We're seeing some rigs move in. We're seeing some people come in. And now I look back 5 years later and my comment is just be careful what you wish for. And I mean that seriously because we want a little development, but we don't know the pace at which that development comes. I understand the industry, the oil industry has always been when the going's good, you get going. And you keep going. One of the things that we're trying to do, I guess, is put a little reasonableness into it. I was glad that Attorney Bjornson pulled up the crew housing facility portion of the Century Code 5702.4, because when you look at that, and I think the question, Chairman Comeen, when you asked about definitions in regard to this, you can see specifically that there's an exception, I think it's in the third line of Section 1 there, and are not mobile homes as defined as 57-55-01. I would like to also include, because what we see, and Mr. Bursch had talked about it, what we see a lot of is, I guess what you would call them here as RV parks. And we used to think of as RV parks was exactly the travelers, the people that would be coming through your community that would pull in a camper, they'd stay for a couple days and you would try to impress them with your community. What we're seeing now is that the RV parks are turning into long-term housing. And these people are skirting. This winter has been great. I've heard had some people from different areas say, wow, it is a little cold up here, and I have to remind them that last year was tremendously, exponentially worse. But what they're doing is they're going down to your Menards or whatever, and they're going and actually insulating that thing from the ground up, putting the insulation on the underneath, plywood, and then sheetrocking, if you want to say, a temporary sheetrocking all the way around the camper, leaving the little entrance open there for where they get in and out, and also where the furnace is. Those are becoming long-term facilities. And, when we first looked at it, we said there is no way that someone's going to want to live in a camper over the wintertime in North Dakota. They've proven us wrong. And so what Mr. Bursch is talking about, the open camps, that's what we're seeing a lot of. Initially, we saw, as is defined up there, the skid shacks, where they could hurry up, drop it down, a self-contained unit, and go. We are not seeing an explosion of that type anymore. We're seeing more of the RVs that are coming in. Or in some cases, Mr. Longner just told me the other day, FEMA trailers that are being placed down. When we're doing and we're looking at our situation right now in Montreal County, we have the time when we've said it's time to just kind of reassess where we're at, and we have the moratorium. I will tell you what we're doing. If someone is doing construction, we are allowing on-site for that person, that company only, for temporary housing. We are allowing that because we realize that there is no other place to stay. But what we're seeing with that is sometimes them, if you want to say bending, trying to bend the rules a little bit even in that. So as Mr. Long there had told you earlier, we basically have been trying to stay on top of this. We have a form that we have had to use, and I would say at least a dozen occasions now already, for non-conforming uses that we send out and have served by law enforcement to try and get the people's attention. And once they saw that we were serious about it, they have come to the table, not exactly smiling, but on the other hand, they know that, you know, that we're serious in regard to trying to keep some semblance of form and some semblance of order in regard to this. I will have to say, and you know, a lot of what we talk about is the con, if you want to say, the bad part of the rural development. There is a lot of good. It's brought a lot of good people. It's brought a lot of good jobs. Obviously, it's brought wealth into the state. I guess what we're just asking is for consideration and to have you understand that with that does come problems, because there is no way that a governmental unit, based upon the rules and regulations that are already in the statute for expansion, and those are good regulations, such as the bonding issues and how you've got to go through the infrastructure improvements, that those things take time. And a lot of times what we're seeing is they don't want to have us take that time. I also, and I have to say this, I also serve as a city attorney for Newtown, Tioga, Stanley, and Powers Lake. And all of those cities have zoning as well. And they're all dealing with this same issue all the way around, plus the unbelievable taxing of the infrastructure that they have, not only with roads, but also with water and sewer. One of the other things that I want to point out, I received an email from Don Longmire, and what we're starting to see more of is something that Gene Bursch talked about, and that was, you know, the inspections, the building inspections. What they're wanting us to do ahead of time is to waive the enforcement of any building code regulations. And they want us to do it in writing at the get-go for the application process. We have been saying that we will not waive those, because then, of course, you lose something else up front. And but that has been a request that we had. Specifically, how that request came in was because of the amount of units. If you get over so many units, you have to have them sprinkled, just like, you know, an apartment building. I think if it's over two units, the third unit, then all of a sudden you have to have a sprinkler system, according to North Dakota code. But you can see with these housing units, what they're asking us to do is they're saying, hey, listen, we want to build this, and we want to build it right away. Will you waive the building code requirement of sprinkling? And we've said no. That has to be, that's an absolute safety issue that needs to be addressed. So I do echo what both the other two speakers have said about some of the other things, but I do want to point that out as well. The open camps are the issue. The closed camps, I think, for the most part, are well run. We've had our little hiccups. We had to remind them that as a closed camp, they have got to keep good records. And I'm just going to throw this out as kind of my last anecdote here. We had to prosecute a case in which there was a sex offender, and we had to prove that that person was residing at that location. They did not have the records. The closed camp did not have the records. They since have changed their record keeping, but they did not have a record keeping system which said that that person slept in that bed on that night. What they had, and they admitted it in a deposition, was that you had a card and you would go and pick the card out, but if my coworker wanted that bed that night, he could go pick the card off the wall and go and check in and use that card. It wasn't my card. It was a card given to a company that could check into that camp. And so we told them that from law enforcement perspective, really that was a real tough sell when it came to when we had to prove, of course, beyond a reasonable doubt. They've since changed that. They were very good at understanding the issue that we had to deal with, and they basically apologized to us as well for the confusion. But you can see how even in the best-run camp, sometimes it can create a problem, and in that case, it was a sex offender registration case. So I'd be willing to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Engit? This section of the law that we have on the screen, and you heard Mr. Burrish say that, refer to this too as maybe having a more restrictive definition. Have you given any thought to what that might be like?
Well, the only thing, you know, I realized for taxation, and this was a taxation type, and I realized that we have the mobile home tax, which has always been in place. RVs are taxed when you buy them as motor vehicles. So there's a licensing fee that you get from them. I guess when we're talking about crew housing facilities, if we're going to create a brand new section, the definition that I would like to include there, though, is RVs. Because in Montreal County, to me, that is the one that is missed completely by this crew housing. And what we're seeing also is FEMA trailers. Now, FEMA trailers, I don't know exactly how they qualify under that definition. I've been trying to figure it out. I would imagine it potentially could be that temporary or permanent basis under the ordinarily designed for human living quarters or a place of business on a temporary or permanent basis. So I think the FEMA trailers might also qualify there. But I think the RVs, if we're looking at this crew housing from a management perspective, not from a taxation perspective, but from a management perspective, I think the RVs have to be given a consideration in regard to that definition too.
When we talk about FEMA housing, we're not talking about something that FEMA has bringing in. It's maybe they've sold the unit to some private person. Is that what you're talking about?
Correct, yeah. And some of those FEMA trailers are what we've seen, in Minot, obviously, with the box shape, I guess rectangular shape. But there also are FEMA trailers out there that have wheels on them, you know, that look like a RV trailer coming down the road as well. So that's why I guess when I was looking at regulation maybe in this area, that maybe we need to consider something that's defined as a recreational vehicle. And it's not just the pull-behinds. You know, we get self-contains as well that are dotting our countryside in Montreal County as well, that are coming into these RV parks. And again, I can't stress how much we've got the mentality really, and I think it's well thought out that RVs were something that you jumped with the family in and you took a trip. These are living quarters for people now. And they may have, and we've got 5, 6, 7 people living in RVs, trailers that are designed for 6 people, and I mean, it's a bed, it's out of the elements, but it also is something we need to regulate.
Well, what would we do in a tax statute that would address the issues that are being concerned here?
Well, I don't know. Like I said, I'm not so worried on the tax aspect side, I guess, in regard to, you know, specifically taxing RVs, because you are paying a fee to whomever you're registering it with, so you can pull it over the road. And I don't know how we can, I've tried to, I guess, in my mind, try to figure out how we take something that is a motor vehicle, a tax under a motor vehicle, or license under a motor vehicle, and all of a sudden move them over into a different taxing mode. And I don't know that there's a good answer for that, Mr. Chairman. But I'm wondering somehow if we step back, if you want to say, from the taxation side and talk about regulation in regard to man camps as a kind of a separate issue, that we can't define RVs as a part of that regulated industry, you know, with the crew housing. And I'm kind of asking that we bifurcate it, look at one side of this as taxation, look at one side of this as maybe health and safety type regulation.
We have this sheet, it says proposed crew camp temporary housing application requirements, that's Montreal County.
Correct.
Do you have a zoning that specifically applies to these man camps now?
Well, yeah, other than there's a moratorium, but yes, we do. What they have to do is they have to rezone, and then they have to do also a conditional use. I mean, that's how we accomplish that, if you want to say, from the committee's perspective, up until the moratorium.
And on the moratorium, that started in September. Is there a deadline for, I mean, is there an ending date for the moratorium? That's
18 months.
18 months?
Yes. Yep. And I can tell you on the conditional use, I believe all of them were five-year. When we started, I think they were all five-year conditional uses. We are getting some that will be coming up here next year. They'll have to come and reapply, because the conditional use will have run its 5 years. I think the biggest man camp that we have in Montreal County is 500 people. And that's just outside of Stanley, about 2.5 miles. Well, actually, no, because the city has expanded. It's probably only about 1.5 miles.
Any other questions for Mr. Angott? Mr. Longmire, do you have any questions for Mr. Longmire? I guess not. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Angott. Mr.
Thank
Longmire.
You. Thank you, committee members.
And I guess I want to ask our commission counsel just to give us a little background on what the stack of papers is that we have relating to all these different ordinances. We'd ask him to collect some from around the state. Kind of run through what we've got here.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. As you just stated at the last meeting, you requested us to try to find examples from cities and counties around the state. We worked with the representatives of the League of Cities and the Association of Counties to get some names, to make some contacts for us, and ask that that we get copies of whatever they might have. And I think I emailed basically every county auditor in the western portion of the state and just directly and asked for copies of their new regulations, if they had any. And then the League of Cities put out on their listserv, I understand, a request for a similar, and Mr. Johnston from the League of Cities provided me copies of what he received from each of the cities involved, or they responded. So I think our stack of information is probably hopefully still in the same order. The first one on top of my stack is, I forgot my glasses, so I'm going to hold it out here a little bit, but I'm looking for the identification on that one.
First Health Unit District.
Okay, thank you. The First Health District one, and as I understand, and maybe Mr. Longmire or Mr. Engel can comment, but there is an effort going on through the First Health District, which is centered in Minot, and they're working as a group to try to develop this draft regulation on man camps, and that's what they submitted. And I'm not sure the status of that.
I don't know either, to tell you the truth. We are not part of the First District Health Unit. We're actually part of Upper Missouri District Health Unit, so.
Okay, thank you. But this is what they are considering, and I know there are a number of county officials that are working with that health unit to try to develop a uniform provision. The next one in the stack that I have was received from Golden Valley County, their definition of temporary crew housing, the procedures to go through to get a permit, requirements of surety bonds for cleanup, depending on the size of the camps, different types of housing that's permitted or prohibited. They permit recreational vehicles, campers, and mobile homes are prohibited as being considered to be crew housing facilities, prohibited activities. So it seems to be a rather extensive one. And if you turn to about the fourth page there, they've got Bowman County is attached to that. Henninger County is after that, and I believe that is the last one in that group of the information that we received. And is this, Mr. Barash, is this the one that you submitted? Is he, I don't, oh, there he is. Yes, okay, that's the one that Mr. Barash submitted to us, the Regional Planning Council working together. One of the cities that we received, Williston's ordinance, again, application requirements, prohibited housing types, and then the permitting process, three-page document that was next in the pile. The entire zoning ordinance from Divide County is attached, the second page has a table of contents. We can more readily find, I think, page through it here. I think Don Connor also sent me the entire, Golden Valley sent the entire ordinance, so that would fit in with what Mr. Barash sent, but I'm still trying to narrow it down here in Divide County where that building regulations seems to start on page 17, I believe.
Conditional uses on page 18?
Conditional uses, yes. I'm not seeing the specific provisions in this particular document. I should also note that, and maybe that pretty much each of the counties that I contacted did respond with either a copy of what they're working on or answer that they have nothing now but are considering things. So I think we did receive a good response from each of those counties. The proposed crew camp document, and this was Montreal County's document that submitted two-sided one-page document that just goes through the items that are needed for the requests and makes it clear what the requirements are. Billings County, which I think was also submitted with Mr. Barish's documents. There are two documents that apply to Billings County, the two four-page documents. City of Dickinson submitted their crew camp housing ordinance. They also, if you might know, refer to the definition of the Century Code for taxing purposes in their definition of crew housing facilities. That's on basically the middle of page one of their ordinance. So the section that is in the Central Code for taxing purposes has also obviously been looked at and considered as a starting point for a definition, at least for some of these regulations. Dunn County submitted their conditional use permit application. And again, much like what Montreal County did, it sets out what they need to submit to begin that process. Yes, we have a second copy that we received of the Dickinson ordinance that is probably a little repetitive, but might be a bit easier to follow in this version. Glenn Allen's ordinance, and this is one of, I think, one of the more recently considered ones. I think it's been within the last few months that this was done. The effective date, in fact, isn't even noted on here, so I'm not certain if they've actually enacted it, but it was one that was just recently in the news as one of the cities that's probably closer to this area of the state that's actually considering these type of ordinances. And again, they also refer to that definition in the taxing provision of the Century Code as part of their definition for crew housing. The large document, the Golden Valley, that again is their entire zoning ordinance. And I don't see in there an actual definition of a crew housing they have a rooming house definition, which is a dwelling of more than three persons, but they don't appear to have a specific definition of crew housing or group lodging beyond that. Representative Gunnersberg, there's a definition separately in there, okay. And again, it refers, I think there's a common theme here where they use that definition of the code as a sort of a model for their definition of what temporary or crew housing is. And this one is very similar, as I recall, to the first one that we looked at that was on the top of the list, with some of the bonding requirements. So I think many of these, obviously one has served as a base for others to work on, and it appears to be some cooperation among the various counties and cities that are working on these ordinances. And finally, the Dunn County Development Board's or their development code. And again, I don't have the exact page, but
page 33, there's some conditional use requirements and refers to temporary housing.
And they also, in their definitions, have a temporary housing unit definition. Mr. Chairman, This is what we received to this point. I think when I sent the inquiries, I had a good response and a lot of interest from the, particularly the county auditors that contacted me about keeping up with what this committee is doing, and many or most of them asked me to add them to our mailing list for minutes and notices of future meetings. So they had a strong interest in what's happening here and keeping them up to date on the deliberations of the committee, and also indicating that they would try to keep us up to date with their progress in areas that this
counties that are still working on draft ordinances.
Okay, thank you. Are there any comments by other interested persons on the subject regarding group housing regulation? Any commission discussion on what do we do now? We had talked in terms of possibly trying to develop a model ordinance. That may be a little bit too ambitious. And certainly, I suppose the Legislative Council office could serve as a repository for collecting these from the various cities and counties so that they are available to any other political subdivision that's looking for it, so they don't have to try and go out and reinvent the wheel on collecting these things.
Mr. Chairman, that was our intention in the office, was we'll make these part of the committee's record and include them in the minutes, but we'll also keep a file on this. One of the responsibilities of this commission and of our office is to maintain a sort of repository for joint powers agreements, and I guess I viewed this as a similar function where we would, at least what's been submitted to us and what will be in the near future, we'll keep a file on it, and we'll be willing to share those with anybody that's looking for assistance.
And I guess in that regard, then, we should continue to encourage these political subdivisions to send us what they have when they amend them, so that file stays up to date as much as possible. I know that there, like even Burley County, I believe, is looking at something like this, although we don't know to what extent Burley County is affected yet, but I think it would be helpful if we do have a file like that at the Legislative Council office. It could be made available to political subdivisions that ask for it. Other commission discussion on the subject? It seems like at this point that's probably where we should leave it, as simply as we're a repository for this and not try to invent anything. Now, on the subject of the tax definition we have on the statute here, what are your thoughts about the bill draft to revise that, to come up with some definition that meets the situation we have now? Any thoughts on that from the commission? What we'll do is maybe we'll ask John to send all the commission members a copy of the statute so that you can be thinking about it maybe for our next meeting. And we'll also ask those other persons in attendance if they have any suggestions as to maybe how this could be handled by something in the Century Code to also give us some comments at our next meeting, a little more focused on this, as to what you think we should do, either in person or by written comments, so that we're getting a little better direction on where you think we should be going. Okay. Yes, Mr. Radnick?
Yeah, I'd really like to look at that a little bit more, too, as far as changing the tax laws. It seems like an awfully complicated issue when we as counties or cities are able to assess the fees as we see fit. Correct me if I'm wrong, is that not taking care of the same situation by the Century Code allowing us to do that already?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Radnick, I'm not I didn't quite understand the question. What is it that you...
I guess if we're going to look at changing how the mobile homes are taxed, like was brought up earlier, is that going to complicate the issue? Whereas right now, as Century Code dictates, we as counties or cities can already exercise fees as we see fit or impose fees on those types of units as we see fit in the crew camp housing facilities.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Radnick, I guess I didn't know that there was any request to change the taxation of mobile homes. Did I misunderstand somewhere?
I don't think we've got any... I don't think we're looking at taxation issues. Okay. More to deal with regulatory issues, as I understood it. From a health and safety standpoint. So I don't know how that fits into the statute. Maybe it doesn't. All right, well, let's move on our agenda then. We're on the 11:15 item, comments by Ms. Renee Lowe, Firefighters Association. I'm sorry we've got a little bit behind on here, but...
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. It's good to see all of you. Thank you for providing this opportunity. I'm here today to talk to you about the fire departments and firefighters of North Dakota. The risks and dangers that North Dakota firefighters face on a daily basis are greater than ever before. The North Dakota Firefighters Association consists of approximately 7,000 firefighters, 376 fire departments, including 4 full-time career and 11 combination career and volunteer fire departments. 96% of the firefighters in North Dakota serve as volunteer firefighters. Additional financial resources are needed for funding, training, and personnel to increase and maintain trained frontline firefighters to protect our state. There is increasing pressure and demands for rural fire departments to perform more and technical services such as EMS, extrication, structural collapse, trench rescue, and hazardous material response. Firefighters in many cases are everything to everybody. The firefighters serve as that first line of defense in emergency scenes. Many volunteer firefighters feel a lack of safety and security. The feeling of safety and security comes with confidence when the firefighter has had the proper training and are also teamed up with other qualified trained firefighters. Probably the biggest area of concern for the firefighters is time. In today's busy environment, how much time does the average firefighter have after holding down a full-time job, parenting, supporting other family members, community involvement, and other activities that expend their day? Yet, our rural firefighters are expected to deliver the desired and expected results rapidly and securely on the fire ground. NDFA is very cognizant of the time issues related to the North Dakota Volunteer Fire Service. The hours that are required for training and the lack of young people staying in our North Dakota communities are issues that we are researching in order to assist our rural fire departments so that they can remain viable in the future. NDFA is aggressively going after grant opportunities that are offered throughout the state and federal networks. Unfortunately, the likelihood of being approved for each grant application submitted is highly unlikely. Therefore, it is vital that assistance and financial support come from state funding sources. Recently, NDFA was awarded grant money through the Department of Emergency Services, Workforce Safety and Insurance, and the North Dakota Insurance Reserve Fund for emergency vehicle operation courses. And also very fortunately, we were awarded $113,000 when we actually made requests to several of the corporate companies in the state of North Dakota. In 2011, the NFPA Needs Assessment Survey reported that North Dakota fire departments do not have enough equipment to equip all personnel. They gave the statistics as 88% did not have self-contained breathing apparatus compared to 91% in 2001 and 78% in 2005. 82% for personal alert safety system devices compared to 93% in 2001 and 63% in 2005. 91% for portable radios compared to 88% in 2001 and 78% in 2005. 97% for structural firefighting equipment training as compared to 91% in 2005. So, what I'm here today for is to visit on behalf of those fire departments and firefighters and ask for your continued support. And with that, I would like to introduce the President of the North Dakota Fire Chiefs, C.J. Craven.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as Renee said, my name is C.J. Craven. I'm Fire Chief from the City of Minot, and I'm also the President of the North Dakota Fire Chiefs Association. Fire departments, I'm sure I don't have to tell anyone in this room that North Dakota is going through some changes. Fire departments, along with everybody else, are struggling. We're being asked to do more. I represent the Fire Chiefs Association, which represents all of the fire departments in North Dakota, volunteer departments, combination departments, and paid departments. What's going on in North Dakota right now is amazing. The amount of crude oil that's being transported by train from loading facilities through our communities is absolutely astounding. These are all situations that cause problems for fire departments. The chemicals going through, and this is the entire state, not just the western half of North Dakota. These trains, the chemicals, the truck transport, the over-the-road transport is affecting the entire state of North Dakota. The sheer volume of traffic, if you've driven anywhere, been through Minot or Bismarck or Williston or anywhere, you know what the traffic is. Accidents. Fire departments respond as primary people in almost every city in North Dakota to do the extrication for automobile accidents. So fire departments are being asked to do a lot, and expenses are increasing. The colleague that was here before was talking that Stanley might need a ladder truck. A new ladder truck, the good news is they've come down in price a little bit because of the national economy. So instead of $1 million, the ladder truck will now cost you about $900,000. It's good news, but it's still probably a little expensive for a small community to have a ladder truck. The other costs for fire departments that are going up, fuel. Just like everyone else in the country, we have to pay for the fuel that we use. Small departments, this can be an issue. Bunker gear, the gear that you see a firefighter wearing, can cost $2,500 for a set. The SCBA that we talked about, the reason that not every department has enough SCBAs for every person on the department is an SCBA costs around $5,000 for one unit. A pumper truck, just a regular fire truck, runs between $350,000 and $450,000. extrication tools, the tools that the fire department would use to get you out of a car in case of an accident. About $20,000 a set. Thermal imaging cameras, that would, great technology that fire departments have now, about $10,000 a piece. So you can see, the cost of doing business for fire departments, all fire departments, is increasing rapidly at the same time that we are being asked to do more throughout the state of North Dakota. And so, the other side of that, and I always think of this, it's the old three-legged stool analogy, is we have to have the personnel, whether we're crew or volunteer, we have to have the equipment, and we have to have the training. So we're here today, or I'm here today, to seek your support. One of the funding sources that we have from the state comes through the Insurance Premium Tax Distribution Fund. We are going to be trying to work with the governor's office and with the legislature to increase that funding, because last year, in 2010, there was approximately $6 million collected from this tax fund and $3,100,000 distributed to the fire departments. That's 56% of the fund. NDFA, which provides the training leg of this stool, is also funded to the extent of $335,000 from this fund. Now, if you look back at the history of this fund, in 1987, I'm not sure how we got this done. Unfortunately, I was working for the fire department in 1987, but the state legislature distributed 110% of that fund, which is a pretty good deal. In 1988, 111%. Since then, as the collections from the fund have gone up, the fire department's share of the fund has gone down. In 2005, the legislature was gracious enough to increase the funding from $2,600,000 to $3,100,000. And it's been held at that level ever since. Even though with what's going on in the state, the tax premiums have gone up. Let's see. And also, just from 2005 to 2012 in North Dakota, it may as well be another century. And I'm sure everyone here is aware of that. It's a completely different world out there now. So just in conclusion, we're looking for support from everybody. The fire departments across the state, along with police and ambulance, are being stressed by what's going on in the state of North Dakota. And the smaller departments are really being hit hard. Some of the little departments on the smaller. Because if there's an accident, train or transportation or anything else, and it happens close to a small town, they're going to be the ones that are first to respond. We can't predict where things are going to happen. And they are going to happen. We're going to have a major incident involving rail traffic and crude oil or over the road. There's been, to my knowledge, within the last month, at least 5 rail accidents involving trucks and trains. So it will happen, and we do need to be prepared for it. Thank you, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Craven? Representative Heller.
Thank you, and Mr. Craven, what budget is the fire department's in? Whose budget is it in during the legislative year?
Insurance department.
So who gets the, what does the, where does the rest of that insurance money?
Any premiums that are not collected go into the general fund.
And other questions? Are there any? Thank you, Mr. Okay, Representative Grubesberg.
I was just going to clarify, the insurance distribution fund, it's 5 lines of insurance, different insurance premiums that come in, so it's 1.75% of things like homeowners insurance and business insurance, things that are related to fire departments. And so 1.75% of those premiums go into this fund. And like Chief Craven said, at one time 110% of that money went back to the fire departments from the cities that they protected. And it's just a allocation by the legislature. So it's not like 100% automatically goes back. And so through the years, that allocation has gone down. So it's just an appropriation is what it is. And so the money that isn't allocated back to the fire departments goes back into the general fund.
Now, Mr. Craven, or Chief Craven, in the next session of the legislature, then I assume your organization will be working to increase the funding through the insurance department budget?
Mr. Chairman, that would be correct. We are working with the NDFA, not just my organization, but the entire fire service of North Dakota is going to be trying to, this is just one avenue of trying to help the fire departments. There's, you know, many different funding sources, grants, things like that, that we pursue. Federal grants are getting much more difficult to come by for fire departments, so the state has stepped up in some areas, but it's still going to take a lot to keep everybody where they should be.
And don't you also get funding from the local political entities that you serve?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. It depends on the type of fire department, how the funding is. Of course, the City of Minot is a general fund department supported by property tax. The Minot Rural Fire Department is a district, a fire protection district. There's many different avenues, and to be clear, I don't think any fire department is asking for state help to provide the normal necessary services to their communities. But when we're looking at a small fire department who has to come out and deal with a train accident or the transportation accidents that really are not part of their normal communities, but that is who is going to be called. One thing about fire departments, if something happens and nobody knows who to call, they call the fire department. So this is what we're looking at. I hope that explained it.
Thank you. Ms. Lowe, I wondered if you could also, you gave us this handout, but I didn't hear any explanation about it.
Yes, I just want to thank you again for your state support, and I just wanted that to be an example to show you how aggressively our volunteer firefighters get out there and train. We just packed up a U-Haul trailer yesterday, totally full. We will be leaving for Minot tomorrow morning, and we'll be training the firefighters all the way through Sunday. We also have this state divided into four different regions, and of course, we're always out there doing regional trainings. We are very appreciative from the state land department that the energy impact grants became available for the fire departments. I will tell you that we did a big rig train the trainer, and then we hope to, you know, get them out into the state. That is a very dangerous, item that the firefighters are facing right now, is going out to those big rig accidents. And it takes a lot of knowledge to deal with what they're dealing with right now. So that is just an example of, you know, those wonderful firefighters that are serving our state. And I thank you very much.
And one other thing, I think, could you provide a copy of your testimony to our commission counsel for including it in the minutes?
Of course I can. Can I email that to John?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much.
Okay. And are there any other questions of Ms. Lowe? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Well, we're right back on schedule. Comments by interested persons, commission discussion, and staff directives. Any discussion from the commission as to where we should go? We've got a couple of the bills that we looked at, which we'll be considering again at the next meeting with some amendments. So we'll be having second drafts of those bills. And also we were looking at some other comments from other people who were interested in some parts of those bills. We will be inviting some other people like Greg Wills to testify at the next hearing on the bill draft relating to the state disaster fund to see what his comments are on that bill draft. We'll also be on the other one on the overweight study, we are going to invite the DOT to come in and talk about the duties that we're putting on them to see if they have concerns, and maybe they can look at, also into what it's, if there are additional FTEs that might be required to handle that. On the man camp issue, it seems like I heard a silent consensus, if you will, that we're not going to try and draft a model ordinance like we thought we might, because that's one, number one, I don't think we have enough time to do that. We may have maybe two more meetings. And but we will have the Legislative Council serve as a repository and make that information available to anyone who wants it, so that they don't all have to try and collect it themselves from every political subdivision or other entity. I think it is a big issue that might warrant some additional study, and one thought I had was that maybe we should prepare a study resolution on the issue of crew camps, crew camp housing, from because it seems like it's a major issue that not only with respect to the construction of them, but also with respect to a whole variety of issues, the infrastructure demands, the health and the safety requirements, a variety of provisions like that, and we could submit for consideration to legislative management when we meet in November a study resolution that this issue be continue to be studied by some committee, maybe this one, maybe some other one, during the next interim between the sessions after the 2013 session is over, because the crew camp housing thing is going to be a continuing issue, and it's spreading across the state. It's coming to Burleigh County, it's coming to other counties where we don't really have that oil development now, but we do have places for crew camps. So maybe I think what I'd like to ask our council to do is to take a give us a draft, initial draft of, for a study resolution to continue studying or to start studying the crew camp, crew housing, temporary housing issue, maybe all aspects of it, the taxing aspect, the health and safety aspect, the construction aspect, building code aspect. Any other thoughts from members of the commission? Yes, Ms. Fry.
Mr. Chairman, I think if that study resolution happens, it also needs to take a look at definitions so we have a more consistent understanding of what we're doing in these different pieces of the Century Code. And so I think that needs to be part of that discussion. And I noticed in some of these documents there's an appeal process some of them don't have. And you know, I'd be interested to know why some of these counties don't have that process. Or what mechanism do they use to take it to the end to make sure that reconciliation happens related to the violations?
It could be enforcement and how violations are handled and that sort of thing could be part of that study.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else? Any comments from any other persons in the audience that would like to say anything about any of these issues before we adjourn? Well,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment. I've been awful quiet today.
You have.
Because my throat is kind of bothering me. But with your last fire people, I wanted to say it's very important, the funding that they're seeking. I have a plaque at home above my desk in my office that says I served 25 years as the chairman of the Starkweather Fire Department, and you know that's an awful small area. And we really depended heavily upon the funding that the fire department talked about here. We had 5 mills on our property within our district, and we had to deal with fluctuating dollars from the state. And I think if we could put our minds to it, folks, fire departments are very important in our local communities, and if we can put a little effort to help them out, I think we should. Thank you.
Other comments? Well, with that, I'll ask for a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
And the second, we are adjourned. Thank you.